Blog Talk Radio.
Yourself in danger when you're threatened by a stranger, when it looks like you will take a licking. There is someone waiting who will hurry up and rescue you. Just call for Super Chicken.
Welcome to the Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show, brought to you by Tractor Supply, where we give away more chicken coops and chicken-related prizes than anyone else on the planet. We are often imitated, but never duplicated. My name is Andy Schneider, but most know me as the Chicken Whisperer, author of The Chicken Whisperer's Guide to Keeping Chickens, and national spokesperson for the USDA Biosecurity for Birds program. Today is Thursday, January 23rd, and I would like to thank all of you for tuning in this afternoon on Blog Talk Radio. This is a live radio show that is broadcast around the world. This radio show is all about keeping backyard poultry, show poultry, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Each week, I welcome experts in their field to share their knowledge about different topics, including backyard poultry, show poultry, heritage poultry, gardening, cooking, and living a self-sufficient lifestyle. Be sure to visit our website, chickenwhisperer.com, where you can follow us on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Once again, I would like to thank all of you for tuning in today to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer, brought to you by Tractor Supply.
The Green Chicken Coop Company designs and builds coops for all breeds of poultry. They are the only coop builder in the country that offers an unlimited range of enclosed, predator-proof runs. Their traditionally designed, classic chicken coops are the envy of many serious chicken fanciers. The health and production of your flock is their main concern. Green Chicken Coop Company is a proud sponsor of the Chicken Whisperer's January Ultimate Chicken Coop Contest. Visit their website at www.greenchickencoop.com or call them at 989-714-7515 for more information. That's greenchickencoop.com.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing.
Do you provide a heat source for your backyard chickens in the winter? In most cases, it's not necessary. But if you choose to provide a heat source for your backyard chickens, it's imperative to use a safe and effective heat source, and the only one I recommend is the Sweeter Heater. The Sweeter Heater is a safe, completely sealed, washable, non-breakable, energy-efficient, long-lasting, and reliable specific area heater that comes with a 3-year warranty. Ditch the dangerous heat lamp this season and invest in the only heater I recommend, the Sweeter Heater. Purchase the Sweeter Heater online at sweeterheater.com. That's sweeterheater.com.
Introducing the Chicken Fountain, a new way to water your flock. The Chicken Fountain will change your life and keep your chickens healthier by providing clean, fresh water every time. No more daily cleaning of dirty chicken waterers. This semi-sealed system keeps every drop of water fresh and clean. Proudly made in the USA, the Chicken Fountain will provide your flock with fresh, clean water for years to come. To order your Chicken Fountain, visit chickenfountain.com. That's chickenfountain.com.
Hi, I'm country music artist Nathan Osmond, and you're listening to Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer.
And the mighty bird against prejudice continues his fight for law and order. So when you hear that cry in the sky, you'll know it's Super Chicken.
All righty, thank you very much for staying with us today on this historic episode of Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Thank you very much for tuning in. Again, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for all of you tuning in, and I want to send a shout-out, as always, to our homeschoolers. Thank you very much for incorporating this podcast into your daily school curriculum. We thank you very much, all the over-the-road truck drivers that I meet on the road and get emails from, that they listen to the podcast when they can. 24/7, they listen to the archive. Thank you very much. Keep the rubber on the road and get that freight delivered safely. All of our live chat room chickeneers in the chicken chat room, all of our live listeners, of course, and all of our archive listeners that listen via iTunes.com, podcast.com, Zoom.com, and others. And last but not least, all the retail stores across the country that stream this radio show live to their listeners. Hope business as well. Thank you very much. I say historic mainly because today is our 900th episode. We've done more episodes than that, but some I've deleted just because I wasn't really satisfied with them, or there was some, I don't know, information in there that wasn't pertinent. Nonetheless, we're probably closer to really 1,000. I probably deleted 100 episodes over the last 5 years of broadcasting. But today, officially, as far as the numbers concerned of archive shows that are available, 900th episode. To give you an idea about that, America's Funniest Home Videos, my understanding, has broadcast about 300 episodes. Friends, the TV show Friends, I think it's about 230 episodes, and Seinfeld, something like 180 episodes. So this is 900 episodes to give you an idea of that accomplishment. I'm very honored, and we're looking forward to having a big, huge show when we hit 1,000 and have past guests, current guests, new guests, sponsors on, the whole nine yards. So we're looking forward to episode 1,000, which would occur sometime in this year, 2014. God willing, I'll be around to enjoy that. The other information that makes this a historic day is I did post on our Facebook page and Twitter and on my personal Facebook page that today I have announced the launch of something I'm very honored and proud of, Chicken Whisperer Magazine. It's been in the works since before Christmas. I've teased about it on Facebook about a major announcement, and today I was fortunate enough to make the announcement officially with a kind of a mock cover of the spring issue to add a little bit of teaser there. But I've got a team of contributors that I've been working on gathering and talking with that I call the Poultry Dream Team. And nationwide, from top poultry universities, top agencies, USDA, CDC, UC Davis University, Auburn University, the whole nine yards, and Delaware State University, certified avian vets, professors, scientists, the whole nine yards. And my goal here was to raise the bar with poultry publications. You know, I honestly, there are articles that are written that are opinion-based and experience-based, and I have no letters after my name. My articles that I'll write will be based on experience and opinion-based, and I will have a few of those. But the meat and potatoes of the article are going to be written by people that, let's face it, know what they're doing. They have the studies to back it up. They want to share information publicly, to educate people publicly about these diseases and information. They want you to incubate better. They want you to have more success with your flock. They want you to keep your flock healthy, just the whole nine yards. I'm very proud to have the dream team, if you will, that we've gathered writing for this publication. And there's still one more big surprise I want to announce regarding the publication, but that'll happen maybe in a day or two. but it will be available in both a digital issue and a print issue, and you'll be able to subscribe to both, and you'll be able to read the digital issue on your iPhone, your iPad, your tablet, your laptop, your phone, whatever, which is really, really cool. And it's not anything condensed or missing from the print issue. It's the exact same magazine, same article, same ads, same pictures, everything. You're just looking at it on your, I guess, Kindle or Fire or whatever those things are called, tablets, things like that, which is really, really cool for the people that are more, you know, I guess everybody now is, or a lot of people aren't. The magazine publisher says they've noticed that a lot of people under 40 like the digital concept, people over 40 like the print concept, so there will be a print issue as well that you'll be able to subscribe to, and it will be delivered right to your home. And it's going to be a very, very reasonable rate, and we're looking forward to this. And so just spreading the chicken love, the accurate and scientific information that we want to spread, and so that's what it's all about. So very happy to make that announcement today as well. So hope that you'll enjoy the publication. We hope that you'll subscribe to it. If you're a business and you'd like to get information about having an ad in the publication, please contact us, and I'll get you that information a little bit later. Also, in every issue, there's going to be a product review. This first spring issue, the product review is going to be about a brand new, redesigned automatic thermostat GQF Hovabator incubator. And one of my good friends, a longtime listeners, and farmer herself, has a small farm in Fort Christmas, Florida. Christmas Chick, she's in the chat room right now. She has written the first product review for our first issue in March. Thank you very much, Christmas Chick. And I proofread it yesterday. It'll be sent on to the magazine company and edited. So there will be a product review in everyone. There'll be different folks doing the product reviews, but I also know that I've already assigned Christmas Chick to do a product review on the a sweeter heater for the fall issue that will come out towards late summer, early fall. So she'll be receiving a sweeter heater. She's going to use the sweeter heater. She'll be able to, for both brooding, as a brooder heater and a coop heater, and she will write a review about that. That'll be for our fall issue. And then we'll have somebody do a product review for our summer issue, winter issue, the whole nine yards. It'll be a good product review done by a true backyard chicken keeper, soccer mom, hobby farmer, not anybody with any letters after their name, just a good, true review from somebody that's in the same boat as the rest of us, just a good backyard chicken keeper that loves the hobby. So I think that's very important regarding our product review. There's also going to be a section in the magazine called Kids Corner, Poultry Kids Corner, and of course, yours truly's wife, Jennifer, my wife, will be writing that, and very anxious about that. It'll be great for FFA, 4-H, teachers in classrooms, homeschoolers, the whole nine yards, an educational concept in each issue about backyard poultry, chickens, how to get utilized in the classroom, in your home, school, at home, as a teacher, as a parent. Really excited about that. It'll have links to special books that relate to the article. It's really, really exciting, so I'm excited about that. So one of my goals is to, I really like the magazine, to cover a little bit more broad area of folks, not just from the beginner, but someone who's kept chicken for 10 years, and have a good article with scientific back study of how they can improve after 10 years of raising or breeding information, and the newest and latest greatest information and studies that have come out. So we're looking forward to this, and the first issue will be released sometime in March, between March 1st and March 15th, depending on what kind of headway we're making, and we are really making quick headway with this. And we're really excited about it. And Heartland Publications Group, who also do Acreage Life magazine and many other agriculture magazines, are really steering this. They are the foundation of the magazine. I will have the editor-in-chief role, and we'll be working with all my contributors, picking articles, making sure that the articles are turned in a timely manner, editing those, reviewing those, sending them to the official editor at the magazine, and then and working on artwork, approving this, that, and the other. So I'm really excited about that as well. So anyway, Chicken Whisperer magazine is now a reality, and we'll have our first issue in March. I'm excited about that. So, nonetheless, today is Thursday. It is Back Home Magazine Hour, talking about another awesome publication. You love it when Richard Frubenberger is on. He is the publisher and chief technical writer for Back Home Magazine. He is our homestead and sustainable lifestyle expert here on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer Radio Show. And you love it when he's on the second and fourth Thursday of every single month. Great topics. This is an interesting one today. And I haven't had time to Google it to see all about it, different options that are out there. But today the topic's going to be cordwood flooring. Cordwood flooring. So that's very interesting. And me having a house built in the 1900, it's going to be interesting to see the different options and what this topic's all about. So, by the way, speaking of magazines, you love Back Home Magazine Hour here on the show. The Love Is publication. They've been doing this for over 20 years. Tons of experience, tons of articles. You can buy one issue or every single issue. You can subscribe. BackHomeMagazine.com is where you can do that. And if you call, then you'll get a real live human being in North Carolina that will answer your questions and be more than happy to subscribe. So BackHomeMagazine.com, folks. So it's time to go ahead to the phone lines, and we'll welcome Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. Welcome, Richard. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, the 900th episode, I see.
It is.
That's
absolutely.
A great time to be here.
Exactly. Hopefully we'll hit 1,000 in 2014. But we're still showing steady with our live and archive listeners. We're still looking at 25,000 listens and downloads, and so we're really happy with that. The numbers staying very steady. And we really love that, and we love our listeners, and we thank them for tuning in. We have a lot of loyal listeners that were back from our first episode when we did a little AM radio in Atlanta to what we're doing now. So, and you've been with us, I know, at least 2, maybe 3 years, and so it's an awesome opportunity to have you on. And you share, you're really, like I said earlier, kind of a sustainable living homestead expert. You come with topics that, because the show's more than just about poultry and chickens. We have gardening and homesteading and sustainability and things like that. And you bring it to us twice a month, really interesting topics that people are interested in, and whether they live in an urban area or a country area or out and they're off the grid, information that they can actually use. It's always interesting. I always learn so much. So today, cordwood flooring. And so, you know, I'm just going to tell you, as the novice homesteader that I am, I think about cordwood being in a pickup truck on the corner, ready to burn in my wood stove or in my fireplace for, you know, $150 for a pickup truck load. And I'm thinking, okay, that's cordwood, at least I would think that's what I would call it. And then I think about flooring and making flooring out of that, putting it in a machine and planing it out and making flooring out of cordwood. Now, I've been way off before on a lot of your topics because I'm not the expert. But how far off I am with this?
Well, it is confusing, and you know, I knew the actual stuff we're going to talk about wouldn't take all that long to explain. But because we're going to have to go through a little bit of background, and I'm sure there's going to be questions and stuff, I knew we'd have probably not enough time to even scratch the surface. But you're absolutely right. Cordwood is firewood, it also is the same stuff can be used as a building material, and not only can be used, but has been used for probably some of the records or some of the historical dating has carried it back almost 300 years in various parts of the world. So, you know, it's not real popular here. I mean, where we are in our region, but it has been very popular in America, anyway, very popular in Michigan and Wisconsin and some of those northern tier states where people have carried the practice from Scandinavian countries over to America, and also maybe showed or demonstrated that it could be an inexpensive way to build a structure using just the logs or wood available in an area. We think of log homes where you use a full length of log, like a 16-foot log, like a log cabin or something like that, 16, 20 feet long. In for a number of reasons, these people did not do it that way. They did it by cutting the logs up like firewood first, and I think a lot of that had to do with actually needing the wood for firewood and then just using it later for building. I don't really know what some of those earlier folks lived in the meantime before they built the house, but you know, the log cabin has been also carried over from a lot of it's probably hard to date, but Scandinavian settlers and some others, other European settlers, and you know, as I don't know, in our area here in the Smoky Mountain region, the natives, you know, the Cherokee Indians lived in, they didn't have teepees, they lived in log buildings. I mean, they actually made their homes of and their meeting houses and their general community places out of long logs, because we have a lot of long logs here and always have. So, but anyway,
let me ask you this, because my brain's going here, and I'm thinking, like, my house built in 1900, it's got the pine, I guess they call it the heart pine wood floors. The strips are probably about 3 inches wide, and they run long ways, and they're all put together and they make the floor. And back in 1900, I mean, I can see where a knot's falling out or a split, and I can see the ground underneath. I mean, there's nothing below it. That's it. They just have the floor joists and this what they call, I guess, heart pine flooring, strips about 3 inches wide. And then I think about flooring today. You see, oh, this is hardwood flooring, which is still made out of wood, and my floor is made out of wood, but it's not called cordwood flooring. Is there what? It's the I may be jumping the gun, but what's the differentiate between the two? Could I say my floor is cordwood flooring? I mean, it's pine flooring. It's just some, again, that's 1900, I guess, made by a machine, like you would put through a machine, cut it in those strips, or you'd make 2x4s or whatever. You just cut it down into smaller pieces, or is this like much thicker flooring that's cut into thicker? I mean, why couldn't I call my floor, say, cordwood flooring built 1900, flooring versus what we're talking about today? I'm just trying to
understand. It's cordwood. Cordwood, it has to be cut like firewood to be cordwood. It has to be your flooring and everybody else's flooring, for the most part, is ripped. It's cut long ways. So you think of a log, and to make the flooring in your pine, hard pine flooring, or any modern hardwood flooring, is cut long ways from the log. In other words, if the log is 8 feet long, it's going to be a strip 8 feet long and two and three quarters to 5.5 inches wide and about 3/4 of an inch thick. And so that's our traditional regular hardwood flooring. But the cordwood flooring is totally different and very, very small. I mean, it's not a common practice at all. But they'll take a log like you'd put in your fireplace, and that's a piece cut maybe 16, 20 inches long, and they'll slice it like a loaf of bread. That's the best way to think of it. Slice it like a loaf of bread, and you can slice it into pieces that are approximately 3/4 or 1 inch thick. So out of a 16-inch log, or out of a, say, 18-inch log, you're going to get 16, because there's going to be some sawdust and loss in the width of the blade. But they'll slice, say, an 18-inch log will make 16-inch slices of wood, which actually gets put flat on the floor in individual pieces like stone or tile.
Okay.
And that's what we're talking about. But
I had to picture that, because I was like, just like and of course me relating everything to food, just like you would a loaf cake, a jelly loaf cake, or a pecan roll or something. They're slicing it, and like you said, a long piece of bread, slicing it just like bread, and then setting a round piece of wood down, just like you would, like you're saying, a round stone or a paver or something like that.
Exactly, a paver is a real good way to think about it, because that's what it looks like. You know, when people build cordwood homes, they take these logs, which are, you know, probably 16 inches, maybe 20. Up north in the cold climates, they can use logs over 2 feet long, and they stack it just like you would stack a firewood stack, except they mix a mortar and put that between the logs. So there's each log doesn't ever touch another log. It touches a maybe a 1 inch, well, probably less than 1 inch layer of mortar, and then there's another log. So it's they build a wall out of logs and mortar, and the mortar is made of cement and pieces of sawdust and some sand and some other stuff. So it's not traditional mortar like we lay bricks with, but it's not too far away from that. And the reason they put sawdust in it is because it needs to bind to the log, so it has to have some of its own material in there to make it stick better. So you can actually build a wall of 7-8 feet high or more, and there are a number of houses. I mean hundreds of houses in the United States made like this, and it's a very, very inexpensive way of doing it. It's not easy. I mean, it's not easy. It's a lot of work. No other way I can put it. It's a lot of work, but it can come in. You can build a home for $6 a square foot with this method, and people have done it. And I've checked on the costs and everything, and we've featured a number of homes in the magazine in our 20 plus years of publishing that are cordwood made all over the country, really. But in this case, this gentleman, who's a builder, actually, he's a professional builder, and he does a lot of framing and contracting and odds and ends, and he lives in Wisconsin. He had an opportunity. What he did was he bought some barn beams. They look like oak. I'm not really sure if they're oak, but they look like oak. 100-year-old barn beams at a swap and shop kind of a deal. And I don't know what he swapped for, but he got a load of 100-year-old hardwood barn beams, cut them into manageable lengths that he could actually pick up with his hands, like 3 foot or so, and then he set up his bandsaw, and he has a fairly big bandsaw. He set them up so he could slice the wood pieces into thin slices. They look to me about an inch thick. Well, no, it's just a little. Uh-huh. Actually, it's about a little less than 3/4 inches thick. I see that right here. And so this stuff was the key to this whole thing, whether you're building a house or whether you're doing a floor, is to make sure that wood is absolutely dry, bone dry. I mean, as 6 months isn't going to do it. It has to be a couple of years. In his case, he was extremely fortunate to get the 100-year-old beams, which are obviously have been dried as dry as they're going to get. If they're not dry, they're going to shrink.
In a barn under a roof, sure.
Yeah, they're fine. Yeah, I mean it's wood is sort of funny, and once it reaches its dryness level, it doesn't really absorb that much more moisture unless you put it outside, and if you do put it outside, once you bring it out of the rain again, it's going to dry back to its normal moisture content. So it has to do with the way the cells are constructed inside the wood itself, but once it's dried, it's going to sort of stay dry, and if you don't dry it correctly, it's going to shrink. So you don't want that. So it's a beautiful floor. I mean, people can check out our Facebook page, Back Home Magazine Facebook page, and see pictures of it. I can't really describe it on the
mm-hmm.
radio show here, other than the fact that it looks like paving blocks, but it's really rich, sort of a golden color. And there's those very characteristic splits in the wood, little splits and just the way wood looks from the end grain. And it's really attractive. And then the fellow covered it in it's a varnish. It's a special non-latex varnish, meaning it's a real petroleum-based varnish. Many layers of that and sanding and buffing, and so the floor is shiny and just real pretty. And I was thinking, what a great advertisement for his business, his contract.
I'm looking at it right now, Richard, and as soon as it popped up, I don't know if it was because back in the day when we had a television watching, it kind of stayed on Home and Garden Network all the time with Jen, but as soon as it popped up, and I see the sheen and the shine and the way it's designed, my mind was, that's a really neat print linoleum floor.
it does look that way. Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah.
It looks like you go and buy a roll of this stuff and just roll it out and glue it to your floor. or it looks like maybe a stamped concrete floor that then was painted. We know about driveways and stuff that's painted and stamped however you want it. That's the first thing that popped in my mind, especially when you look down past the stone fireplace there and right kind of in front of the wood stove where there's some light coming in off of the window. I mean, right there in that light, it honestly, to me, looks just like linoleum flooring that you could buy in this pattern. This is amazing.
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing. It does look like a high-quality linoleum, but it's really wood. And the thing is, it's being wood, it has a little give to it. So the floor isn't hard like concrete. And it's very soft on the feet, and it just has a nice, warm, nice warm feel without being delicate. I mean, it's a durable floor and a durable finish.
Let me ask you this: is that I'm looking at this house? It looks beautiful. And let me ask you: what is underneath that? Is there a concrete foundation? Is that just set on dirt like the olden day? You know, this is obviously. I guess that's a two-part question. One, as I look at this, I can't tell if that's on a second floor or a first floor. And then I guess my first question is, what's underneath that to give it support? And then two, the one on your Facebook page here, is this technology something that I would see 300 years ago, or is this kind of a new modern reinventing itself, modern day, put in this beautiful $500,000 home type of technology that's changed
a little bit? No,
this is a new,
I wouldn't even call it technology, it's just a new use of a material that's been around for a long time. And this guy's home is not anything fancy at all. It's just basically I wouldn't even call it a farmhouse. It's just like a regular, I mean, he lives in the country, but it's just a regular old house. What's under there looks like something
that would be, I'm sure it's beautiful, but I look at it, I'm thinking some beautiful log home on the front of a log home magazine but I can see also somebody in an urban area, I've got cork floors in this beautiful home, or I can see this becoming a status for maybe some of these homes in more urban areas for people to, quote-unquote, brag about. Well, I've got cordwood flooring, and that may be the next big thing under the Corian countertops, marble countertop, granite countertop, and now we'll see cordwood flooring as a bragging right, maybe. This is
it looks that way. The picture that you're looking at, and if any of the listeners are, he's all dressed up like sort of a Western
right.
guy. I mean, that's a big hobby of his, to do a lot of hunting, a lot of like riding. I think they raise horses but for work, it's not like a hobby with him.
Right.
And they do some, I'm not quite sure all what they do, but it's an interesting little mix, of things they do, and as I said, he's a building contractor, so this is really a labor, a sort of a work, work and hobby thing for him too. But what's under there, and the difference between what you're talking about with your older farmhouse and a modern way, what's under there is a layer of subfloor, just plywood, just like any other modern house. They put in a three-quarter layer of you have the joists, and then they nail down a three-quarter layer of construction plywood, and then on top of that they put the finish. Well, sometimes they put a little medium-density fiberboard or something to stiffen it up, and then they put a finish floor, which could either be linoleum or hardwood or laminate or tile or whatever. But in your case, in the old days, in my old house too, my old house, did not have a subfloor. It's just like you said, you nail down the building I'm in right now in our office is like that. There is no subfloor. It's just the boards are nailed right down over the joists, and you can see if I was to poke some places I can actually see through, but I can stick a little knife through there or something, and I can see the ground. I mean, it's
absolutely
It's
funny. Our joists also are like 2 feet apart or something. My dad's an architect, has been all his life. He looked under there and just kind of shaking his head. But then in our dining room, there were a knot fell out of, say, a piece of wood or something, and there was a hole maybe, again, small. They have, and I love it, just adds character to the house. In two places in our dining room, there is a soup can lid that's been screwed down over this knot hole. So they don't have to look down and see the ground below. So I've got two soup can lids, steel soup can lids that are just kind of, I'm like, what? And then you can figure it out. You don't have to be a genius to figure out what happened. There was a knot in the floor that fell out, and they just put a little soup can over it to block the end of the knot hole so you don't see the ground below. So that's I love it. That's great.
Yeah, yeah, you can plug it. I mean, you know, you could cut a piece of wood round and make it fit the knot, but why do that when you have soup can?
Right.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Now, so is this, I guess the obvious question next, since you answered my first one about what's underneath that, how much more / less energy efficient is this compared to a lot of the other flooring?
Well, energy efficiency is probably not... it's probably not a whole lot. Actually, depending on what you're talking about, it's probably not quite as energy efficient as a traditional floor, because in traditional floors they use layers of felt underneath and they have some underlayment and some other stuff. So it, you know, it probably is a little more resistant to heat loss. But
mm-hmm.
this stuff is much more sustainable and much less expensive and you know, more natural, I guess, is the best way to put it. So, you know, there's always that going for it.
So even looking at this floor, this finished project, looking at that, and again, this may be, again, top of the line when it comes to this, you know, cordwood flooring, but looking at this floor on your Facebook page and seeing that, you're telling me that that is much less expensive than a lot of the other flooring that's out there available?
Oh yeah, yeah. Like a hardwood flooring piece, even at a big box store can run minimum of like $2.99 a square foot, and some of them go up to over $5 a square foot. Just ordering
even,
them from the store.
Okay, even if you know, because some of this floor, you know, $3 a square foot, but you go in there and it snaps together and you're done. Your labor cost, your labor time is so nothing. Even if adding. Maybe, and again, I'm assuming here, the added labor and time it takes to do this floor, or that may be deceiving as well. It may not be any more time. Even added labor cost, it would still run less expensive?
Well, no, what I meant, the material is say, $3 a square foot. And then the labor, of course, is $2.50 and up a square foot. I mean, some guys charge, in my area, you know, $3.50, $4 a foot to do it. What I'm saying is this material is essentially if you use your head, you don't have to pay anything for the wood. I mean, there's a lot of wood out there
right,
that people
right.
would love to get rid of just to get it off their property or
mm-hmm.
to get it out of their front
mm-hmm.
yard when the DOT comes by to widen the road or to do maintenance. They cut trees and you know you just have to drive up and down and find it, and you have a pickup truck
mm-hmm.
and a chainsaw. So that's what I'm saying is material cost is cheaper. The effort, it's work to put it down. I wouldn't necessarily say it's any more work than,
mm-hmm.
it just takes more time because you have to let the adhesive dry and then you have to grout it and all that stuff. But it's basically the same time as doing a tile floor, you know, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, people have tile, you know, that's.
Right.
But you, you know, if
and
you,
you could
have
also
access
have
to wood.
Your...
You can do it. You can do the whole job. You know, given the fact that you do it yourself, you can do the whole job for a lot less money than you would pay. You know, than you would
uh-huh.
normally paying somebody to buy the wood and put it in for you.
Right, and then I guess you could have fun with it. Like our living room is pine, our dining room is pecan, our bedroom is maple, or you know you can get different varieties, obviously, of your wood base, and I guess they all may have a different. End up having maybe a different color, different, you know, patterns, different, you know, so you could just like for today, if you want bamboo or oak or all these other different cork and things like that, you can I guess, for lack of a better term, play around with what suits your taste and maybe even have a different rooms of different wood.
Yeah, yeah, and most, you know, for this purpose, most species of wood would be fine. I mean, you could use oak or hickory or pine or... you know, birch, whatever you wanted to, and yeah, you'd have the different colors and the different grain patterns, and all that kind of thing. I mean, it's it's a matter of artistic, you know, ability and just how you see things and whatever. But this guy just happened to, you know, happened to get a hold of this barn beams, and they, you know, they're generally made of some kind of hardwood. But you know, and that's the other part, like the hardwood, like the reason you can go under your house, or the one the office I'm in now, our back home place, and you can see those big spacings, is because in those days, the wood was full size wood. I mean, it was not a 2x4 today is considerably thinner than a 2x4 than a real 2x4 of say, you know, 100 years ago. In those days, they cut it full, and it was heavy and thick, and the wood was better, and so they could space out, and the joists wouldn't need to be spaced as close because they could hold more weight because they're bigger and stronger. You know, now they have to be a certain way because the wood just doesn't, you know, it ain't like it used to be. You know, so that's the reason.
Looking at this floor too, it's absolutely beautiful. I'd love it in any house that I'd ever own, and it's beautiful beyond my expectations. And I would have it in my home, but I have to make an official announcement, ladies and gentlemen. If you are OCD, it may not be the floor for you. I'm looking at, you know, the different shapes and the different sizes, and they don't quite, you know, the corners may not, you know, you know, meet up perfectly. So it's jokingly, because it is a beautiful floor, but I'm looking at it and looking at, you know, the mortar and the different. I'm looking at the. Looking at the pieces, how that would make a beam in an old barn, and I'm thinking, yeah, if you're really severely OCD, this may not be the floor for you.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, and that's part of the character.
I'll tell you,
he did. These logs had a flat top and a flat, or two flat sides, you know, because they were beams. They had to have two. Yeah, think of a log, and then he cut two sides flat from it. So it has one flat side, and just on the opposite side, it has another flat side. So when he cut the wood like slices of bread, the pieces have two flat sides and two rounded sides. So he had to think of how to do that. And what he ended up doing, talk about OCD, he made all the flat sides go north south and all the rounded sides go east west. So they all had more or less the same orientation, but they're not all the same size exactly, and they're not all the same shape exactly. So there's a little bit of variation. So it really does add some character. And of course the grout fills in the spaces between the log pieces, so you know that it all smooths out at the end when it's all finished. So you know it looks good, but it's smooth on the top, so that's all you really need for the floor. You know, it's level and smooth.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't stick up or anything like that. I mean, he cut them all the same. He made a little jig, so he cut every single one the same thickness, so it worked out real well. And what I thought I'd do is I just go through a real quick sort of how-to.
Okay.
I know it's sort of hard to envision it, but I think I can try anyway. You know, how he did it, he basically his starting point was a subfloor, you know, just a wooden floor with, you know, raw material, wooden plywood floor. And what he did was he cut his dried wood into slices of about somewhere between 5/8 and 3/4 thick is what they ended up being, and every single one of them is the same thickness. So he's got hundreds of pieces of these log platter-like pieces to work with. It's a sliver or section. And by the way, the floor he had to do was 600 square feet, so it wasn't a tiny floor. I mean, it's you know, enough substantial. So he what he did was he used an adhesive, a special construction adhesive, to glue down. Well, first he didn't glue it. First he played around with it quite a bit. So he dry laid the pieces on the floor, to see what would look best. I mean, you know, first he established that he wanted the flat pieces going north south and the rounded edges going east west. And once he'd done that, he sort of like a stonemason, you know, they'll take the various stones they have and they'll sort of lay them out roughly to see, you know, see what they look like, and they may change it around before they actually fasten them permanently. So he fiddled around with a section at a time, in the, you know, maybe in a corner, and then did some over another part of the floor without gluing them, and just sort of get an idea of what they look like. And once he was sort of happy with it, he started the process. And what he did was he got a construction adhesive and a notch trowel, a 3/16-inch notch trowel, just like you'd use in tile work. And they're $7 at the store, no big deal. And he used following the instructions of the adhesive manufacturer. He worked in little sections, like he's just doing a small section at a time, so the glue doesn't dry over, because you can only work so fast. So he would take the trowel, and he's just buying 1 gallon buckets, so he doesn't expose a whole 5 gallon bucket all at one time to the glue, because he couldn't work that fast. So he works in a corner. I would imagine something like this, probably a 3 by 3 foot space, maybe a little bigger, and just spread that construction adhesive with a notch trowel onto the subfloor, and then he stuck down the flat sections of sliced wood in the pattern that he had predetermined that he figured would work, you know, work best, and just made sure that each section, each piece of wood was stuck to the floor firmly, following the instructions, and pressed down, you know, the way it's supposed to be, and tapped down with a little rubber mallet or something like that, and then did one section at a time, so it completed maybe a 3 by 4 foot section or a 3 by 3 foot section, and then just let it set up, and then moved on to the next section, and the next section being about the same size, and he put down his fresh adhesive, followed the instructions, so he didn't let it skim over. You have to let it work within a certain time frame, and he just carefully placed the next batch of wood in the adjoining the first batch he put down. So he moved along the whole floor doing this, and you know, I'm sure he just worked up until a point. And the next day he wouldn't be applying more glue. He just let what he did set and harden. And then the next day he'd come back and work on another 3 foot section, or you know, 3 or 4 foot section. So you know, working this way, he said it. He did it. He didn't do it steadily like he had every day. He didn't do it because he had to work. He had to work his regular job. So he'd do some here and some there, and some on weekends and some at night. You know, but he told me that that a floor that size, about 600 square feet, would probably take about 2 weeks to finish, completely finish. If you had, you know, the time to do it, you know, taking normal breaks and working 6 hours a day, something like that. So it's not like a quick job, but it is an inexpensive job. And so basically, after all this wood was put down, and what he did is when he hit a corner or a wall or around something, he had to work with. He could cut if he had to. He had to cut the wood to meet it, but what he tried to do is try to keep complete whole pieces where you could see it, complete whole pieces intact, so you could work around the fireplace or a uh-huh. A doorway or whatever like that. So it'd be a whole piece, so it would look. And he can make up the difference elsewhere in places where you really don't see it. He was able to make up the difference in fitting everything together right, because there's a lot of leeway between the each piece. I mean, there's some of the pieces have, I'm just looking at a picture here, some of the pieces have, looks like an inch and a half between, and some have, on the flat sides, they have a standard grout line, which is, well, in this case is probably, gee, I don't know, maybe looks about 5/8 of an inch, maybe more, which looks fine with the size of the pieces of wood he has. And in, on the rounded parts, though, he doesn't have that luxury of having all that perfectly straight edge, so some of them are an inch and a quarter, some of them look like 3/4, and you know, so, but it looks, when it's all said and done, it looks fine. But he said once the slices were firmly set and secured to the floor, you couldn't do anything with them for at least 24 hours, and more, some of them he just let dry even longer just to make sure they were set. But once they were set, they were set, and they were, you know, they weren't moving. They were very firmly did. He didn't use any fasteners, didn't need to use any screws or nails or anything. He didn't want to because he didn't want to be able to see the heads through the top of the surface. So these things set you know, set real well, and they're firmly down. The other thing that was pretty important, he learned this from experience, is to initially he had started, he didn't put any finish on the logs on the surfaces when he grouted. So when he put the grout in there, the grout gets all over the everything. So it doesn't. So what you do is you wipe the grout off, except for what's in the cracks, because what's in the cracks stays in the cracks, and what is on the surface comes off the surface. So that's what makes it. You know, it's just like tile; it makes it show. He initially did not prep the surface of the wood at all, and it was very difficult to get that grout out of the out of the wood. And he had to sand it and sand it and sand it. So what he suggests doing is to give a thin layer of varnish or you know, some type of polyurethane or some, generally the varnish over all the wood first. Once it's either before you actually glue it down or once it's been glued, but just put a little layer of varnish over the wood so that it can be it'll protect the wood part of it from any grout, because the grout will not stick to the varnish, and so you know, it'll you can clean it off then very easily. And so that's one of the major things he pointed out, is that we, you know, really need to put some layer of something over that surface of the wood to keep the grout from sticking excessively over it. You know, I'm thinking that you know, sealing top surfaces is just whatever you're going to use to seal the you know, the whole floor should be just used moderately over the top surfaces of the wood. Now the grout is just regular tile grout, but what he did was he mixed it, because he's working with wood. He mixed the tile grout. He picked the color that, you know, that he was comfortable with, that would match the match the wood. And anybody who knows tile knows that you can pick. There's probably, probably 36, if not more, colors of grout available. Everything from greens to browns to tans and whites and blacks and, you know, dark blue and all, just all sorts of stuff. Well, he picked sort of a brown, tannish brown grout color to match the lighter shade of wood that he had, and then he mixed in the sawdust that he had gathered from cutting all the little slices of wood. He kept in buckets for use of mixing it in with the grout. So he mixed in about 20% sawdust with 80% grout, and then he mixed in the water necessary, like you would a normal tile job, to get that grout to a consistency where you could float it or spread it over the floor. And the way you do that is a thing called a float. It looks like a square trowel, but it has a rubber bottom on it. And basically what you do is, once you've mixed your grout up into a mushy sort of a, it's not too mushy, it can't be too thin, but it's like a movable, I don't know what you call it, like a plasticky putty kind of, it's sort of a thin putty. You just sort of wipe it into the spaces between the tile or the logs in this case, and it'll fill the hollows and it'll get all over the faces of the logs too. But he just, that using that float, you just sort of force it into the cracks and end up wiping it off of the surface of the logs that you're basically treating like tile, and then later you go back and take a sponge and you clean off the actual tile or log faces, so all that comes off, and it'll stay, the grout will stay in the cracks and at the same level, and then the wood will be free of all the grout, and it'll be just its clean face of wood. Now in this case, you wouldn't do this with tile, but in this case, it being wood, he had to go back and take a sander and just make sure that all the grout was off of the surface of the wood, so that you could see the grain and the cracks and everything, and all the nature, the natural character of the wood he wanted to show. So he just went back with a little hand sander and just got that loose grouty, you know, concrete material off the faces of the wood. And so once he was happy with that, swept everything up, you know, made sure, vacuumed it all up, make sure it was all, the grout, of course, had dried by this time, but clean it all up so it's, you don't have any dust or anything left on it. and then ended up applying a traditional non-latex high-quality commercial varnish floor sealer onto the whole surface. Now, you know, a lot of people, I imagine you could probably use polyurethane, but he did not, and I have a feeling he did not, because he knows that the commercial varnish is actually a better product for longevity and a long life of the floor. It's more expensive, but I'm assuming he had experience with hardwood flooring before. He knows that the varnish is just going to make a better seal for this stuff. So he ended up just putting layers of petroleum-based or traditional commercial varnish sealer onto the surface till it dried, and then he buffed it with a wool pad, which is what you do on a normal hardwood floor, and you put a coat on, you scuff it with a pad. And then you put another coat on, and you scuff it, and just until you get as many layers as you feel you need. And then you to get the gloss surface you want, you buff it with a much finer wool pad, and it really brings up the shine. And that's what you'll see in the pictures. This process is something you can Google anywhere and find out. Process for doing a traditional hardwood floor, but that's exactly what he did. It didn't make any difference between the cordwood and the hardwood. He did it the same way. And so this is what takes time. You have to buff the floor and then let it dry off and clean it off again, and then put a new layer of varnish on it and buff that off again and let that dry let it dry and then buff it, and every layer takes its own time step. So that's why it takes so long to do it. But once it's done, it's done, and it's durable, and it's beautiful. They were careful. Go ahead.
I need to take a commercial break when you wrap up this little segment here.
Yeah, it's fine. At this point, we can do that.
Okay. Oh, okay. Very good. All righty. We're talking with Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine. We're talking about cordwood flooring today, and absolutely amazing information. The pictures are outstanding that he has posted on his Facebook page, and really getting the education today. It is gorgeous. Now, I have a question for him specifically when we come back. So there'll be more when we return on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer right after this short break.
When you need an incubator, think Brensea, the incubation specialist. Brensea has been a world-leading manufacturer of incubators for over 30 years. Incubators from 7 to 380 eggs with high-quality electronic and digital controls, including precise humidity control and programmable egg turning, all at surprisingly affordable prices. Visit them online at Brensea.com. Brensea spelled B-R-I-N-S-E-A. That's Brensea.com, or call 1-888-667-7009. Enter the coupon code WHISPER at checkout and save 10% on their incubators, brooders, egg handlers, and other incubation accessories. When you need an incubator, think Brensea, technology you can trust.
Ideal Poultry has been a family-owned and operated business since 1937. Their business is built on customer service and quality poultry. From rare white and brown egg layers to broilers, ducks, turkeys, and bantams, Ideal Poultry is the largest supplier of backyard poultry in the United States, shipping close to 5 million chicks annually. Visit them online at idealpoultry.com. That's idealpoultry.com.
Ware Manufacturing has been building quality hutches since 1983. Ware manufactures modern chicken hutches, barns, pens, and nest boxes designed especially for the backyard flock. Ware offers hutches and pens for every yard size and every chicken keeper's budget. Visit their website at waremfginc.com. That's waremfginc.com. Or call them to find a retailer near you at 1-888-824-7257. Ware Manufacturing. Pictures of chickens on aprons are common across America, but picture a chicken wearing an apron and you'll probably get a good chuckle.
Laugh if you must, but nothing protects hens better than the Hen Saver Hen Apron. Hen Saver Hen Aprons protect your hens from the damage caused by an overly affectionate rooster and may even provide protection from an unexpected hawk attack. Hen Savers come in several different sizes to fit both bantam and standard-sized hens and roosters. Colors include camo, denim, navy, brown, khaki or black, and soon pink. Crazy K Farm is expanding its already colorful Hen Saver collection to include the color pink. A portion of their sales will be donated to organizations that fund breast cancer research and awareness. Order your Hen Saver aprons today at hensaver.com. That's hensaver.com.
Mount Healthy Hatcheries has been a hatching tradition for over 80 years. Home of the healthiest chicks, Mount Healthy Hatcheries offers a wide selection of bantams, turkeys, guineas, ducks, pheasants, and of course, meat birds and layers. Order online at mounthealthy.com, that's mthealthy.com, or give them a call at 1-800-451-5603. Don't forget to ask about their free bonus chicks offer. Mount Healthy Hatcheries, home of the healthiest chicks.
Actually, in reality, I am Super Chicken.
Alrighty, thank you very much for staying with us today on Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. Our guest today is Richard Frudenberger, publisher of Back Home Magazine and chief technical writer. We're talking about cordwood flooring today. Very interesting, and he's got a great and beautiful picture on their Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com and search for Back Home Magazine, or you can Google it like we talked about, and he's was walking through all of the installation process. Now, it sounds like there's a pretty steep learning curve if you don't do your research ahead of time, and he was talking about the grout and things like that. So just from listening to this, Richard, it sounds like if you do it yourself, if you have the confidence to do it yourself, the tools to do it yourself, and you've done the research and you're ready to tackle the project, that yes, it can be less expensive, obviously, because of the product, but then you're doing the work yourself. But I don't know, it just sounds to me like if I hired somebody to do this floor, it would be more than just the snap-together hardwood. Again, there's no comparison. This floor is the Mac Daddy, don't get me wrong, but it just sounds like with labor cost, it might end up being equal to or more than maybe some of the other flooring that's out there if you're having to pay for installation too. Am I wrong on that, or just am I over... exaggerating just what you've told us so far as this, maybe, and even some of the corrections he had to make, which again, that's more time and labor.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I'll go even further. Most contractors wouldn't touch this with a 10-foot pole. it would take them too long, too much trouble. I mean, they get set, in a mindset of what they're used to, and most professional people don't want to change. They know they can make money doing X, Y, and Z, so why should they work on L and M, you know? This is definitely a do-it-yourself, self-reliant lifestyle kind of thing. I mean, if you had to pay somebody to do this, even if you got somebody who's enthusiastic about it, it would take them a long enough time that I'm sure you would spend more money on labor or paying somebody on labor than you would on a traditional floor, because it is not click snap together and traditional nailing and all that stuff. So that's what the beauty of the whole do it yourself mindset is that you're enjoying it. It's your labor, your effort and your accomplishment. So, there it is.
Absolutely.
But the other thing about this, I mean, I was looking at some of these pictures myself because I was thinking, like you said, about it looks sort of like linoleum. But the fireplace that people see in that picture is actually a hand-laid masonry stove that is something like 22 tons of stone that you don't need to feed armloads of wood into this thing to keep the house warm. Once it starts up, it burns a little bit of wood, and the rocks absorb so much heat that they just ooze heat for the next day or so. I mean, it's like they don't feed it all that often. So it's a whole different, and we've also done articles on this kind of thing. This is this gentleman is not a stonemason. I mean, he's not a he is something of a stonemason, but that's not all he does. And he did a lot of research, but he ended up building this stove from a set of plans, and he really did a good job. And up there where he lives in Wisconsin, it's very very cold in the winter, and they have to think about how much wood they want to go through. You know, should I cut 15 cords of wood this winter, or 12, or 17? You know, so anything that can help them, help save them effort on cutting firewood is welcome. And he's done a good job on this. And we actually through this guy here that we did the story on, he's advised us on we're doing another story on another start to finish masonry stove project in an upcoming issue that he helped us gather information on. So I'm real excited about that.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, I'd be standing in front of my stove and my floor if I did it myself too with that big smile. I would be definitely proud with that. And talking about a labor of love, though, and the feeling of accomplishment.
They're both real nice folks, and you know they're definitely country people. And he's just in conversation and working with the author on this stuff. They hunt and they provide for a lot of their own food. That's sort of why he dresses up like that. I mean, he sort of almost wishes. I'm sure he wishes he lived back in 1850 sometime. You know?
I think we all do sometimes. Sometimes, not all the time, but sure, we all can say, the good old days, right? And then all of a sudden we have to, I'm telling you, I'll be the first to tell, even on the homestead now, if I had to provide my own food all the time, I'd starve to death. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I mean, I've planted some good gardens before and have had some success and have had some downturns, but, I mean, man, I'll be the first to say, if I had to survive on only what came off of my property at my homestead, I'd probably drop some weight, which would be good, but I think I'd probably starve to death. It's just amazing. So when we say good old days, depending on what day and what trial or tribulation we're going through, we say, the good old days.
I've thought about that more than once. So even just getting firewood and keeping the fire up and all that, it's a major effort. And that's why people had huge families back then too. I mean, everybody had a job to do. You know, there was no unemployment.
And a two bedroom house, and they had 9 kids, and not 9 bathrooms like some houses today. 2 bedrooms and 9 kids. So and they survived fine. I'm sure they had a lot of smiles on their face and happy. I'm sure it was hard work. Yeah, absolutely. Looking at some of the pictures from back when and things, but. I think about if you only could cook on a wood-burning stove. And here it is in South Georgia. Our house has the vent still there. It's been trimmed out. You can see where it was from a wood-burning stove in our kitchen that went and escaped. And I'm thinking on a hot summer July, August day when it's 98, and I'm thinking if I had to start a fire to actually cook in my kitchen, which is actually on the west side of the house, so anytime after 2 p.m. as the sun sets, the kitchen gets, it gets so hot. In our kitchen, I said, if I had to start a fire right now to cook supper, there's no way. It just amazed me. It's like, great day. Bless the people who had to do it in this house right here, because there's no way I'm going to do it. It's hot enough with an electric oven that I've got in there that came with the place to turn it on and start cooking in the summer afternoon as the heat bears down on the house. So you're right. I guess it's been the good old days, I guess, is all relative based on what trial or tribulation you're going through and what day it is.
Well, back, in those in the South especially, I see them even now, people had summer kitchens. The kitchen was, they had a whole separate place for the summer kitchen. You know, it was outside the house, so they didn't have to worry about the, this roof and everything over. It's like a big open, a big open porch thing, but it's it would take all that heat out of the house, so you don't need it in the summer for sure.
What? That was crazy. Now, great information. Any other information you'd like to share in your outline there before we call it a show?
No, I think we pretty much wrapped it up. I just thought it would be a real good thing to mention because it's sort of hard to talk about how to stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to actually get the gist of it. But I think this whole concept, either as a floor or as a building material, it's a real good thought for people who have the time but may not have the money to do the construction, and it just makes sense.
Yeah, and it's absolutely beautiful. Beyond my expectations when I saw that picture, it was absolutely stunning. And yeah, kudos to that gentleman and his wife. They've got a beautiful place there. So thank you so much, Richard Prudenberg, a publisher of Back Home Magazine. You can visit them online, backhomemagazine.com. You can order online. You can call and order and talk to a real human being in North Carolina. They'll be happy to take your order. And more of this, a lot more of this, is in his publication that comes out every other month. Very affordable as well. Richard, thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you back here in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you, Andy. Bye-bye.
Yep, thank you. Bye-bye. All righty, very cool. Great show. I always learn something new with Richard, and which is a good thing. You got to learn something new every day, and especially if you're into the homestead, the sustainable living, the getting back to nature, the doing it yourself. All these tips that he brings on the second and fourth Thursday is priceless. And really, really interesting topics that Richard brings to the show. We're glad and very fortunate to have him. So thank you, Richard, again. That's going to wrap up another episode of Backyard Poultry with the Chicken Whisperer. And we do ask that you'll, join us over on Facebook, facebook.com/TheChickenWhisperer. And then, of course, Twitter is just twitter.com/BackyardPoultry. And no show tomorrow, of course, it is Friday, but we'll return this coming Monday. This Monday will be another great episode of Ask the Chicken Doctor with Peter Brown. So we hope you have a wonderful Friday. We hope you have an incredible weekend with family and friends, and we'll see you back here Monday morning, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. God bless everybody. Thank you.